Kol HaLashon, the entire Torah, everywhere.
Hi everybody, welcome to Coach Menachem Berchel on this beautiful Sunday night. Thank you for joining us. Tonight is share 224, and I just want to welcome everybody and thank everybody for joining every week and for people that post it on the status and let people know about it. So Sikh Saverim, a place to talk through very important things that are happening, important topics, and really get some clarity. If anyone wants to join the WhatsApp chats, we have the community chat, please WhatsApp me at 732-314-1710. I'll also post on the community chats, I can post on the Zoom chats, our community chats, so you can see the speakers, the replays. You can also go to menachemberchel.com and sign up for his flyers and get all the information on what's going on Coach Menachem. If anybody's watching this on YouTube, you can click on the like button, the subscribe button, so every week when we post the videos, you get automatically notified. Thank you to all the advertising sponsors of the Lakewood Scoop here in Lakewood, Ellie and Ariel from Five Town Central, and Chayla Kaufman from JCN, the Jewish Content Network, are always promoting us on all the Jewish digital platforms. Okay, if anybody's here the first time, every Sunday night at 9 p.m., it used to be 10, 9:30, now down to 9 at 9 p.m., now we move the clock, it's really 8 o'clock, 9 p.m., every Sunday night, we have a very deep shiurim, whether it's Torah, Chizuk, therapy, some interesting topics. Much of next week, March 16th, we're going to have an amazing share. It's not confirmed yet, so I'm not going to announce it. Hopefully in the next day or two, we'll make the flyer, we'll send it out. And March 23rd, we have Reb Shalom Usha Tauber coming out to give a big discussion on self-care, which is my topic I pushed him to talk about. So that should be interesting. So again, please join us. Much should be a very powerful and amazing program. Next coming week, this week, last week, as they're all amazing, we're going to share 224. We're going to turn the camera to the Aron Noach Fried Shlita to give the gematria for 224.
Shalom Uvracha, everyone, to Zoom share number 224. Navigating the challenges of personality disorders, support to family members and spouses. One of the most important ways you can support your family member or personality who has a personality disorder is by giving them the proper honor, respect, and treating them with dignity. Which leads us up to tonight's gematria of 224. When a hakan ben kovet, we will treat them with honor.
Beautiful. Okay, yeah. We're going to turn it up now to Coach Menachem Berfeld to give the opening, why we're here tonight, what we're here to discuss. Take it over.
Shkoyach Bar Noach for the gematria. I want to welcome everyone. Welcome to another Let's Get Real with Coach Menachem. Baruch Hashem, with Siyata Deshmaya, we're doing number 224 tonight. And it's his first to have Matis with us again. Matis does a lot of good work, and we're going to hear more about it tonight in Mitzvah Shem. We're in the month of Mishnechnes Adam Marvin Besimcha. In a few days is Purim. I'm sure everybody's getting ready. After last week's talk, we had a little bit of comedy, how important it is, even in therapy, how important it is to be able to make a joke, to laugh, to be able to let go. And we discussed to be able to trust in Hashem. And the whole Megillah, when you're in it, sometimes it's dark, it's black. You don't see any reason to laugh. But if we know there's something behind it, it could help us a little bit. And then it helps us to find a little bit of light, even in the darkness. I think that brings us a little bit to our topic tonight, dealing with personality disorder. Many people are in a place where it's hard. And trying to figure it out. So, you know, talking about any personality, two people together, there's no two the same. So we all have different personalities. You know, I have mine, and the other person has it. You have a conversation, talk, communicate, to understand the other. It's not always easy. Forget about disorder. But when it comes to a disorder, it becomes really challenged, and we get lost. And we had different talks on the Coach Menachem from past experience. Every time we brought it up, there was always the other side that wasn't happy. And it's just very hard to make everyone happy and everybody feel validated. Not always that easy, and people feel offended and judged. People pointing fingers, don't blame me, it's always them. So it's a topic that's not easy to talk about, but it's something we need, whether it's physics or skills of how to. Many times when a person is in a relationship, especially when it's personality disorders, the confusion is just trying to do everything right and walking away feeling you're not doing anything right. And trying to be so good, and then everybody's telling how wrong they are, and very, who is right, who is wrong. And then you go to the therapist, and it's hard for the therapist to validate both. And I don't know, one of them walks out. No, I'm not coming back. This is not for me. It doesn't work. He doesn't understand me. So we're going to be talking about this tonight, but the feelings that come up, many people have the feeling of hopelessness. You know, it's not working after so many years of work. Loneliness, depression, feeling that there's really nothing I can do. I've tried everything at a loss. There's a lot of grief going on. So my tefillah is that in Mitzvah Shem talk tonight, you know, the shliach with Matas Miller, somebody who deals with these things, we should be able to feel a little bit of being able to understand, a little bit of clarity, and whether it's skills or just understanding, so that we should be able to take a deep breath and see what are the possibilities, Mitzvah Shem. So Mitzvah Shem, we should have a lot of siyata d'shmaya on tonight's talk. Shkoyach.
Shkoyach l'shmanacham for the beautiful opening. Okay, let's get into it. So we entitled tonight's program, Navigating the Challenge of Personality Disorder, Support for Family Members and Spouses. Very big topic. And I'm going to mention what I mentioned again. Matzah Zadar, I don't know, was it about 2 years ago, Menachem? Matzah Zadar?
Yeah, it was March 2022.
Oh, literally, 3 years ago.
3 years ago, yeah.
Literally 3 years ago. So we did a topic on this and there was a lot of feedback. And like Menachem said, this, you know, there's two sides to every coin. And, when you talk about one, talk about family members as one, we talk about the person themselves, another. Over here, we're really focusing more on the family and the spouses, that angle. I'm going to read about Matas's bio, and here we go. Matas Miller, LCSW, is the founder and clinical director of the InReach Behavioral Health and Intensive Outpatient Partial Hospitalization IOP program, providing cultural sensitivity, intensive mental health treatment for greater Lakewood area and beyond. With 20 years of experience, he has specialized in severe emotional and personality disorders, teen and adult anxiety, and parent training. He holds certificates in CBT, DBT, and schema therapy, that a seasoned lecturer focused on supervision, education, and consultation. Matas is also the founder and director of the Center for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapy of New Jersey and the author of The Uncontrollable Child. So Matas, just before you go into your bio, if Matas opened the IOP intensive outpatient over here in Lakewood, it's around for about 8-9 months. And I would just like Matas to just give us a minute or two if anybody knows about it, anybody could use it, if you know people that could. Matas, explain what it is, and then please take it straight into your bio, into your opening.
Thank you so much, Asher and Coach Menachem, for having me here again. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be here. So as far as InReach Behavioral Health, it's a state regulated facility that's in New Jersey. So to date, most people in our community who needed a higher level of care, and we're talking about coming to a facility from 3 to 5 days a week for 3 to 5 hours a day. So it's really for intensive therapy, which includes group therapy, individual therapy, family therapy, med management. So that's for people who are really struggling with emotional and behavioral difficulties, mental health related difficulties. And sometimes it's stepped down from hospital or residential. Sometimes they're in therapy and it's not enough. And they really come to a facility like that to get very, very supportive intensive therapy to help them be able to learn skills and strategies to stabilize, to regulate their emotions. And we're addressing things like anxiety, treatment-resistant depression, people struggling with severe postpartum, someone has a psychotic episode for bipolar disorder mania. We also have a specialized track, an eating disorder track. We're actually the first from facility in America that actually is now has a nutrition team that people are stepped down, those struggling with eating disorders. We have separate tracks. We have a track for adolescent females, a track for adult female, and we're starting now a track for male adults as well. And we're really focusing on evidence-based, giving the highest level of quality care, right in Lakewood. So it's not, we're really breaking those barriers, for mental health treatment and right here in Lakewood, and people come from out of town as well to be able to get that treatment in an environment where they can feel, comfortable and safe and secure, and the power of the group and the environment and the setting. So this was something we've been working on for 3 years. We've been open about 8-9 months. We have a beautiful facility in Lakewood, 5,000 square feet. You can look up, on our website in reachbh.com. And this was something that, you know, was inspired. Someone came to me and said, this is something that we need in our community. And I'm just, I feel blessed and that I can provide this and that we can provide it. And, I can say to date, we've been really, providing excellent service right here within our community. And even the parents who are sending the children or the individuals themselves, like to be able to come into an environment, and feel comfortable and that's sensitive to their needs, has been pretty incredible journey. So just wanted to share a little bit about InReach Behavioral Health. So with that, we're going to open up today. So as both Coach Menachem and Usher said, it's been about 3 years where I gave a talk on focusing on borderline personality disorder and the importance of healing. That was episode 96. You can go back and check that out. So it was really, it was a fascinating talk. And it was actually quite intense. You'll go back and see some of the interactions that were going on. But really the talk was understanding borderline personality disorder, understanding the struggle, the pain, the diagnostic criteria, what they go through and the causes and the reasons for what's going on, and really give people some insight into the life of someone who has BPD. However, on that call were many who are family members, who are spouses, who are children of those with borderline personality disorder. And it was painful. I can imagine to hear an understanding or a validating when they are the cause of that person's struggle and disorder is really harming them and hurting them in a very, very significant way. So recently, actually, I was at a conference somewhere and someone came over to me and said, you know, you did a great job. You really tried to balance, validate both sides, but really you need to do something for the other side. You need to be something to help the families or the individuals who are actually struggling and living with someone like that. And I took their advice, and I called, Asher and I said, what do you think? So he said, let's do it. So here we are, to talk about this really, really important topic. I think before we start, I have to tell you, I was anxious today. Okay. I said, am I having some post-trauma, you know, from this previous episode? Like, how am I going to be able to navigate this topic at the same time, really be all inclusive and address everyone's needs? So one thing's for sure is no matter what we're talking about today and whatever disorder a person is struggling, the goal is to address this without judgment, without blame, without pejorative language. And I know that it's easy for me to say sitting in this chair, because when you're living with someone or interacting with someone who's struggling with a personality disorder, the pain and the language that's popping in your head on a regular basis is quite intense because of the hopelessness, the pain, the tiredness of just feeling every way I go is just not right or not good enough. I think we have to keep in mind as we talk about these today that with all being said, as I write in my book, The Uncontrollable Child, a diagnosis is what they have, not who they are. So our diagnostic criteria is a way of understanding what people are experiencing, but it doesn't label and define them. And I think we have to keep that in mind. I think we also have to keep in mind is that when we talk about different personality disorders, which we will, there's a continuum. People have traits. Maybe many of us have traits. Doesn't necessarily mean we meet the full criteria for the disorder. And many of us are dealing with different levels of intensity, and not everything that's going to be said is going to fit every situation, and each one is individualistic and personal. With that being said, I think it's also important if that someone is on this talk tonight and they are struggling with a personality disorder and they are trying to learn and grow, which I give them tremendous amount of credit for doing that and trying to help themselves, this might not be the right talk for you today. Not because we're going to say anything or hide anything, but perhaps someone who's emotionally sensitive or was really trying to embark on that journey and we're really focusing on the other side, that could be really, really painful. for them. And therefore, I really send you back to my other talk, because that was the focus of the previous talk. You're welcome to stay, but if you think it's too much at any point, it's completely understandable if you close. And maybe at a different time, when you're more in a emotional, stable place, maybe going back to it, and you want to learn what the other individuals in the family or people you know, how it might be impacting them. So although they're in significant pain, and as I talked about, their behavior, the outcome really deeply can harm those around them. And as I like to say, you know, as a clinician, as a therapist, we sit in therapy with someone for an hour, maybe 2 hours a week. You know, it's one thing to sit there with helping someone and working with someone for that hour. And I can say, and maybe perhaps I can never really understand the experience of someone who's actually interacting with someone who has a personality disorder. But I've often said in my mind, I can handle an hour, maybe. I can't imagine what it must be like for the family members living with such an individual on a daily basis. And that's really, really difficult and hard. And there are many times that enabled me to have tremendous empathy for those family members who are trying. And it's difficult. And I think I could say myself, we've all come across people who have had personalities, difficulties and struggles. And, you know, it could be the person in the grocery store, the person, you know, in your shul, the person in your, maybe some group of friends somewhere. And it's a problematic relationship. And what do? You can end the relationship. You could put really strong limits. You realize this relationship is not going to work for you. But it's far more complex when it's your family, when it's your child, when it's a parent, when it's a spouse. It's not like, oh, we can just walk away from the relationship. And it's not always the most effective thing to do to walk away from the relationship for many, many reasons. I always say as a therapist, it's certainly not my job to ever tell anyone to end any relationship, because that's not my role and it's not what I do. And I see people sometimes that I cannot imagine how they're staying in a relationship, and they're staying. And then I see people is that I can't believe they're ending this relationship, and they're leaving. So I think it's really important that each person has to really look within themselves and see what makes the most sense for them. And sometimes relationships can be really dangerous and abusive and complicated that they need to end. And sometimes it's hard to find that balance. But they're complicated. They're complicated because attachment and emotional bonds and shared history, and there's so much involved. So what I hope to talk to you about today also is that it's not this all or nothing. There could be a balance. With the mate, perhaps certain skills, you can have a healthier dynamic. Keyword, healthier. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be all better. There's no magic pill. But are there things that I can do to help my, as we said in the title, to navigate these and cope more effectively and be more effective in my interactions? So that is sort of my first part of this introduction, to understand the complexity of interacting with people who are struggling with personality difficulties. So someone might say, you know, the title today is Challenges of Personality Disorders. Aren't there many personality disorders? If anyone knows, there's cluster A and B and C, and there are so many different personality disorders. And I was thinking to myself, like, there is so much I can talk about today, and I have this 20-minute intro, and then we're going to have all these back and forth and trying to assist with the questions. Does it make sense to make this so broad? So what I'm going to say to you is yes and no. I think if we really hone it in and focus, I think what's going to happen is many of you are not going to feel like we touched upon areas that you're struggling with. And I see that. I've seen that when I've talked in different venues. When you bring up certain personality disorders, suddenly other issues start to come in where people are struggling and people don't feel like it's addressed. At the same time, we also have to be aware of what we can accomplish. And much of this, this is not a psychopathology class. We're not having lecture after lecture here. This is something to give you some knowledge and idea to help you move forward. So what we are going to focus on today, just to give you some education, is what we know as cluster B personality disorders. And those are usually marked with some dramatic emotional erratic behaviors that specifically really make it hard to have a stable relationship. It makes it very challenging. And there are four cluster B disorders, and we're really going to only focus primarily on two. The first is antisocial personality disorder. Maybe some of you are familiar. We're not going to focus too much on that disorder, but that's a very deceitful, manipulative behavior, lack of empathy. Now you might say, hey, isn't that narcissism? We'll get to that. Yes, there could be some of that in there, but antisocial is really emotionless, complete lack of empathy, and very deceitful. And that's why you see a lot of people who struggle with antisocial personality disorder are known as serial killers, and involved in crimes and things like that, because they really do not feel much for other people, and they're extremely devious. The next is borderline personality disorder, which I mentioned, and that's really marked by this emotional instability, specifically with a very, very strong fear of rejection and abandonment, which we'll talk about, which I spoke about in the past, and an impulsivity. And that leads to instability in relationships. So there are very extreme in relationships. The third is a narcissistic personality. And that's where we talk about a feeling of grandiosity, a need for admiration, also comes with a lack of empathy, not taking any responsibility, sense of blame. And the fourth is histrionic personality disorder, which, again, I don't think people are as familiar with. And that's where there's this excessive emotionality and very focused on attention-seeking behaviors. And there's a lot of instability, quickly taking on a persona, quickly, you know, attaching and connecting something to an extreme way. You know, like someone shared with me today that they had a client who just went off to Israel, and suddenly he calls and he screams, "I'm a Zionist." And he has a Israeli flag and he's running around Israel and screaming and yelling. And this, he had no connection to that like 2 weeks before, but he suddenly went to Israel and he's running around Tel Aviv as a Zionist, which is fine. But that might be indicative of like an histrionic attention, excessive emotionality, extreme change of clothing, change of language, taking on a new identity very, very fast. We're not going to focus too much on that. What I primarily want to focus on today is what we know as borderline personality and narcissistic personality traits. It's not called disorder, character traits, which are very complicated in terms of their impact on relationships. BPD is actually, there's a higher level of BPD in the population. Approximately 1.4 to 5.9% of the population meets criteria. That's meeting criteria. That doesn't mean many, many people have those struggles. And of course, in clinical settings, it's probably upwards up to 10%. So once you're in a clinical setting, they change, where narcissistic personality is much, much less. It's 0.5 to 1%. And as we know, it's much more frequently in male. That doesn't mean it cannot be in female. It can be in female, but more frequently in male, and BPD more frequently female. So BPD is fundamentally an emotion regulation disorder. It's individuals who are experiencing intense emotions that actually lead to impulsive actions and behaviors, which affects relationships. So I want you to think about it as extreme emotional vulnerability. You see the emotion. Okay, the emotion is so intense. And that emotion could go from anxiety to shame to anger, whatever that emotion is, sadness, even empathy. They're feeling it really, really, really powerfully and strong. And that's not necessarily a problem, but if they struggle with their ability to regulate those emotions, that's where it can be hurtful and impact the people around them. So that includes very, very briefly, as I said, the fear of abandonment. There's over-idolization of relationships, or under or devaluation of relationships, swinging back and forth. So I am the most amazing, incredible therapist that ever existed. I mean, I've been to 50 therapists. If people were just like you, I mean, the world would be saved. Like, why can't there be more people like you? To the next day of, you know, you did the most hurtful, horrible thing. I don't know whoever, you know, I don't know whoever did that to you. And I, you're going against the ethics of, your degree, and, you know, on and on and on. So you could, it can be that, that extreme. And then it's this, they suffer with this struggle, which I talked about in the last talk, this chronic emptiness, these mood swings, this out of proportion anger, but it's coming from this deep, deep emotional pain. Narcissism, narcissistic personality disorder is different. That's more of an over-control disorder. So there's a lot of focus on grandiosity, preoccupation with themselves, with fantasies, with beauty, with belief that I'm special, I'm unique, I'm a high-status individual. And there's an excessive focus on admiration. Their speech, their dress, every nuance is there just to attract attention. Oh, I connected to this one. I know that one. They'll question you immediately. I remember one of my a couple I saw many, many years ago, and I walked in, and the couple sat down, and the first thing the man said to me was, you know, I lecture to people your age. So that's how he started, you know, and then immediately he had to, you know, level that, lower the playing field, so to say, you know, had to have me in my place. By the way, just so you know, I'm, you know, a pretty important guy, and you're a little youngish to be really doing this type of work, and therefore sort of putting my place. They can have exploitative behavior, a sense of entitlement, and lack and empathy. That doesn't mean they don't have the capacity for empathy. They lack empathy, we'll talk about. And they envy other people, and they believe other people envy them. And they have a very arrogant attitude towards others and behaviors, and don't take much responsibility for when they hurt people. And that's where people know things such as, you know, gaslighting and things like that. They'll shift the blame in every way possible. And there are two types of, this is more, you know, common slang. People talk about overt narcissism, covert narcissism, which are important. Overt narcissism, obviously, as you can understand, that's really a person who's very strong in their admiration, arrogant. They're out there. They're engaging in behaviors that are hurting other people to get their needs met. And then there's covert narcissism, and that's very subtle. That's where the person really constantly needs. That insecurity is there, but they constantly need attention, but they're not asking for it. They're using very passive aggressive tactics to seek that understanding and that validation. So let's understand like how these two are somewhat similar. There are common threads, yet they're different, as I mentioned. Because both BPD and NPD struggle with emotion regulation in different ways. Because someone who has a borderline personality trait or characteristics, their intense emotions, such as emptiness and anger and anxiety or sadness, there are many of those different, those are the common emotions, and they shift very, very rapidly. Of course, that could also be in euphoria and joy and pleasure and things like that. Someone who struggles with narcissism also has intense emotions, but those emotions are most often coming out as shame and rage and humiliation, especially when their self-importance is challenged. When you hit that area of insecurity, that's where you'll see a dysregulated emotion on the other end. Both of them have sensitivity to rejection, to criticism. Someone who's borderline personality disorder have extreme reactions when they feel hurt, and they turn to self-harm, where they have these really outbursts due to their fear of abandonment, trying to take control that people don't leave them. While the narcissist, again, will also have a lot of, when there's that rejection or criticism, defensiveness, because their inflated ego is being challenged in the moment. And therefore, they're also reacting to the criticism in a very strong way. And both of them lead to instability in relationships, because people with BBT who have these extreme fluctuations, as we talked about, between idolizing and devaluing relationships, they create these very intense cycles of love and hate in the relationship. And that's, again, very much related to that underlying fear of being left alone. While a narcissist may form relationships based completely on admiration and validation. So therefore, they might initially idolize others, but once those others are not filling their needs, their respect, then they quickly devalue them. So that's why there is a part of the relationship also is idolization, because anyone who's, you know, interacted with someone who's struggling with that, grandiosity, and you're interacting with them, They are praising you. They are making you feel special and unique and really bringing you into that relationship. But as you get more intimate in the relationship and they feel like you're not understanding their needs, which they're focused on themselves, then it becomes a difficulty in the relationship. So really both of them, I'm not going to get too much into this, but both of them really have that vulnerable self. And if you want to say, because in like schema therapy, we talk a lot about part of the work is trying to connect to that vulnerable child, to that emotional child. So even the one with narcissism, underlying, they have these strong walls, these strong protective modes to help them feel they're self-soothing, they're seeking admiration. But under that, there is that vulnerable little boy who's really in so much, there is so much pain, there is so much insecurity. And what we do in therapy, we try to, through lots of work, try to get to that underlying and help bring out the empathy and the vulnerability, which is not always possible. Can be possible, not always possible. So, certainly the one who's struggling with borderline personality disorder also has that underlying vulnerable child. When we conceptualize personality disorders in general, we really look at many of these traits as overdeveloped strategies. I love the example I heard years ago, and that was referring to OCPD, which we're not going to talk too much about today, but someone who has obsessive compulsive personality disorder. That's not the same as OCD, but that's someone who's very rigid in terms of rules and morals and organization and details and value to an extreme. Now, when we have nuclear power plants, you want the guy with OCPD running. Okay, that is a strength. You just don't want to live with them, but you want them to run those power plants. If you have someone who has a narcissistic trait or capability, okay, you want them perhaps, I'm not getting into this now, but I'm going perhaps to run your country, perhaps. Okay. I'm not stating that, but in other words, you want them to be a leader of your company, right? You want that strength, that ability. Again, at the same time, you might not really want to go home with that person every day, right? So those are overdeveloped strengths. Even in terms of someone who's struggling with borderline personality disorder, again, their emotions, a lot of them, what attracted family members to them or appreciated their emotion because they have passion and creativity and care and empathy and space for so much. At the same time, it's a struggle. Most of these, they develop ways of coping, and most of these ways of coping were actually adaptive and necessary at some point in their lives. So if you're going to talk about someone who's struggling with narcissism and overly focused on themselves, maybe perhaps when they were a child, the only way they would get attention, here's one conceptualization, from those around them was by focusing on themselves. Or that's the only thing their parents gave them any value. And they needed to keep focusing on that value in order to survive. But it became unhealthy as they grew up. So there are healthy traits, but they become overdeveloped. And they hide behind those coping modes. I could go a lot more into this, but I'm going to move on because, as I said, I'm just giving you just an overview. So I want to just briefly talk of some basic strategies in in interacting with family members and so on, because this is extremely hard. But before I do so, just because you use a strategy, that doesn't mean it's going to work. That's number one. Number two is sometimes not being in a relationship or ending relationship is where you want to go. And that's something you have to figure out and decide and explore with whoever you're going to explore and figure out the cost-benefit analysis of doing that. The other thing is doing a lot of these things are not simple. It takes a tremendous amount of work and motivation. And the question you have to ask yourself, you know, is this something I really want to do? Is this worth to invest? So when I list off things, you know, it might be easy to say here, but we have to understand this takes tremendous amount of work. And a lot of that's doing that work in therapy. But before you even do that, Usher mentioned earlier self-care. Self-care is huge because if you're in a relationship or a situation like this, you have to take care of yourself. You have to learn to prioritize yourself. You have to learn to find the healthy relationships, the healthy outlets, You have to learn, if you're a person who's just so focused on pleasing other people, you're not helping others if you don't take care of yourself. As I say to people in unhealthy relationships that the person's not going to change, the goal is for you to become the healthiest version of you so that you can be able to cope the most effectively with those people in your environment. And that might be the work here, ultimately, although we can essentially make change, but working. And it's not fair. I said, it's not fair. I don't get to decide what's fair. God decides what's fair. And our understanding of fair is certainly different than his. And we trust in him that he understands that there is a picture here that's larger than we can. But there are certain dynamics and situations. And I'm not trying to say by any means that any of this has any sense of fairness. So with that idea, and we can talk about that more, but let's talk about some skills and strategies, specifically with someone who's struggling with borderline personality disorder. The first thing, which is super important, is respond with calmness and stability. Now, it's easy to say when someone is heightened emotion, who's saying very, very hurtful things. And I think it's most important, better not to interact and take a break from that conversation than to have a conversation, because we know that change is transactional. And when we escalate, that is going to affect that other person. They are going to escalate. And when they escalate, in all likelihood, you're not going to have the emotional intensity as that other person, or that person might be more powerful in certain ways or might know how to trigger you in certain ways. So really learning how to prevent further escalation by you feeling internally secure and safe and confident within yourself, and learning how to be very mindful, self-aware when your body is triggered, when your schemas are triggered, when your emotions are triggered, and learning how to take a step back from that conversation, and also having supports outside to go to someone and say, am I saying, what am I saying? Does that make sense? You know, is there rational? So you can feel secure and confident. But if you notice your emotions getting intense, dysregulated in some way, it's a time to become very mindfully aware. Notice your breath. There are many, many exercises that you can do to take a step back and go back in the conversation. When I teach interpersonal effectiveness skills in dialectical behavioral therapy, one of the first things I teach people is, on a scale from 0 to 100, your subjective units of distress, when you're above a 30, no interpersonal effectiveness. It's out the window. You have 0 to 30. Some emotions important. But if your emotions are that high, it's not going to be effective. And even if the other person is, you know, dysregulated, take that break. Number two is validation. Now, validation is very, very hard, but validation really helps regulate the other person. And the idea is because it helps them feel understood. What we have to understand about validation, which is most important, and I'm not teaching validation today, but the most important thing to stick out for family members, validation does not equal agreement. You can validate without condoning a behavior. Validation is not to validate the invalid. You validate the valid. Okay? You can validate their emotion because their emotion is valid because it's real. You can validate their thoughts. You can validate their perspectives. But you can't validate that you're stupid. You can't validate that it's all your fault, because that's not the valid. And they're really, it's really a skill set, and I can recommend some books for how to really learn how to validate someone's experience. And it really is the magic in that interpersonal interaction, especially with someone who's emotionally sensitive, because they grew up with a lot of invalidation, perhaps, and they engage in a lot of self-invalidation. So your ability, they have difficulty regulating their own emotions because they don't know how to validate, and you can take a role in validation. Number three is setting boundaries. And when you set boundaries with someone who's struggling without a lot of emotion, just like a child in a way, I'm not calling them a child, but when they're in that childlike state, you must be clear. There's no room for ambiguity, confusion. It's being very assertive and clear and setting up those realistic boundaries. I will not respond to you when you're name calling. Follow through with those consequences. It's so important. And as a parent, or as a spouse, or someone who's sensitive and you care about the other person, this is not about being mean. You're not being controlling. It's about building a healthy relationship. It's about being assertive and being compassionate. And while you're doing that, especially with someone who's so fragmented and so scared of being left alone, reassure them, I'm committed to you. I'm here for you. This is not an attack. I cannot have a conversation this way. Or this is something that I do not feel comfortable doing and therefore I will not do. And what's most important about all these pieces is not something that actually I saw written anywhere, but this is what I call
HaLashon.
Make space for their emotions. I see so many people who are struggling with the other person who has emotion dysregulation, that the person leaves stamping their feet, gives them silent treatment for 2 days, and they feel internally, they like, how could they do this to me? This is so horrible. This is so terrible. This is not fair. Let their emotions be, because your reaction is actually reinforcing the process. I can't go into that now and explain that cycle, but you need to allow them to be upset. It's okay if they're upset. It's okay if they're angry. It doesn't feel good. And after you like gave them the world plus and turned over your whole daily schedule just for them, and now they're getting angry at you because you said something the wrong way, right? So for you in that moment to go ahead and break down internally and start to, well, I'm so sorry. You know, what can I do? I see you're so upset. That's not going to be helpful in the ability to maintain those boundaries and let those emotions be. I'm going to talk briefly. Those are just, again, I'm going to review that. Responding with calmness, validation, setting boundaries, making space for emotions. In terms of skills when you're dealing with someone with a narcissistic personality. So first thing, you have to know your own schemas. I see the dynamics of these relationships, these underlying states and core beliefs, is that many people who get into these relationships themselves feel unworthy, themselves struggle that I'm unlovable, themselves fear rejection or have a history of abuse. And therefore, when the individual interacts with them and dismisses them or gaslights them because of their own fear of rejection or their own worthlessness or their own sense of adequacy, they immediately break down internally, which actually keeps the cycle going. Also, many feel helpless and the loss of control and powerless and manipulated. And that you have to become aware of when those things come up. Now, I understand if that you, in your really abusive relationship, if you're going to show more assertiveness or more power, then you're going to get pushed back with more power. So we have to talk about how to do that in an effective way. And also many people are desperate for approval from the narcissist. They are charming. They're the way they come across, they have everyone fine. They want to be part of them. They want to please them. They want to earn their love, and they're working so hard because they're so loving and they're such caring people, which is a wonderful trait, but you need to identify how that's keeping you stuck in an unhealthy relationship. So one of my mentors, who I have learned a tremendous amount from over the years in understanding personality disorders and treating personality disorders, is Wendy Bahari. Wendy Bahari wrote the book, Disarming the Narcissist. Excellent book. Talks about a lot of these concepts. And Wendy speaks about a skill called empathetic confrontation, which is a very, very powerful technique, and which talks really about how to have empathy, okay, empathy for the individual and their emotion while confronting them. So you're validating their emotions. You're even in a way giving them their admiration, giving them their, making them feel good, at the same confronting them. And you're being very direct. So in other words, you're going to say to them, you know, when you start to call me names, I understand, it makes sense. You were really hurt by that situation, or, you know, your work is really important to you. And a lot of people look up to you for that because you're really good at it. And I really want to be connected to you, and I really want to have a relationship with you. I just feel really hurt when you do that. So then someone's going to say to me, he's going to say, yeah, stop with your psychobabble. Okay. Just grow up. Right. And then confront again. Now, a big part of being able to do this is leverage. Okay. Especially with a narcissist who's really on the extreme, that there has to be some leverage. And sometimes leverage is their relationship. They have to be in enough pain to make change. If they're not in enough pain, we talked about someone with borderline personality disorder is in enough pain. Their pain is very intense. Okay. And you feel that and it hurts you. But for those, they have such a wall up that they're actually not necessarily feeling so much pain. So unless there's a leverage of the pain in so much, or they realize they're going to lose their relationship, they realize they're going to lose their job, they realize they're going to lose something that's really important to them, they're going to lose their kids, that gets them to a place that's willing maybe to crack open, and then you can start the work perhaps, okay? So it's really also setting the boundaries. If you continue to shout at me, I'm leaving. Yeah, so leave. Who needs you angry? Okay, we could role play that whole interaction, but it's the ability to follow me and be consistent and say, you know, I'm going to leave, and I hope, I really want to connect you and have this conversation. I'm hoping later we could sit down and try this again because I care about you, and you have a lot to offer a lot of people, and you have a lot to offer our relationship. So it's being empathetic, and I know this hurts you too, but this is not going to work for me. And you really have to stay calm and non-defensive, which is very hard when you're being triggered and every button is being pushed and you're putting down. And then try to problem solve together. So there's a lot more to talk on that, but I spent a decent amount of time sort of giving this overview. There's another great book, by the way. Shari Manning wrote a book on loving someone with borderline personality disorder. That might be another great resource. So as we open up to questions and try to navigate the complexity here, I hope to sort of give you an overview of these characteristics and people struggling with personality disorders, and also understanding that there might be some skills and strategies that, you know, they're not always effective, though they're important. Also taking care of yourself. And also, again, I'm acknowledging anyone who's living with someone who's not getting help and not making a change, kol hakavod. That's all I can say. I can only imagine, and you know, Hashem should repay you and give you the continued strength. That doesn't mean they're not hurting and they're not having their own struggles, but the amount of harm that could come to you is pretty extreme. So with that, I'll open it up.
Thank you, Matt. That's beautiful. That's a well-prepared opening. Appreciate it. Okay, we are going to first take a poll, and then we're going to go to some live questions. Again, anybody here, you with Matas. Matas is the best of the best. That's why we bring him on so much. And please take this opportunity to ask anything you want on the topic. Okay, here we go. Two simple questions. Everybody answer to the best of your ability. Number one, which aspect of managing a personality disorder within your family, in the family, challenges you the most? Number one, maintaining my own self-confidence. Number two, coping with loneliness. Number three, feeling that my needs are not being cared for. Or number four, providing care for my family. Second question, what is your belief regarding the treatability of personality disorders from your non-clinical point of view? Number one, they can effectively manage with proper support and therapy. Number two, they are difficult to treat. Second, my thing is bouncing. They are difficult to treat, but improvements are possible. Number three, they are mostly unchangeable with minimal potential for improvement. Or number four, I'm not sure. Need more information to form an opinion. Answer those two questions. Take your time. Five more seconds. Five, four, three, two, one. Here we go. First question, which aspect of managing a personality disorder within the family challenges you the most? And pretty interesting poll, 37% of people maintaining my own self-confidence, 16% coping with loneliness, 33% feeling that my needs are not being cared for, 15% providing care for my family. So basically maintaining my own self-confidence and feeling that my needs aren't being cared for are pretty much tied. And the next two are coping with loneliness and providing care for my family. Matas, any comment on this?
My comment is it's probably not fair to the person who's doing the poll because they probably want to say one or two or three of those.
Oh, we're doing the most. You got to choose the best All of the above.
Yeah, no, I'm not surprised. But it really highlights something I said before about, you know, if you can maintain your own self-confidence and get into a healthier state, you can be more effective in navigating this relationship. So I really sometimes where we can't change the other person, we could change ourselves, and we change ourselves can affect the environment. Again, I know that's not fair, and maybe overall in other places I have really healthy self-confidence, but this person has a way of, as I said, you know, layman term, pushing down button, and making you feel so insecure with yourself. And I think learning how to be more aware of those somatic experiences when they're triggered, the beliefs that are triggered, those schemas that are triggered, how it relates to your path, will certainly help you navigate that relation more effectively. And the other thing is also important. It's this other thing about self-care. Your own needs aren't being cared for, and understand you can work to get those, but sometimes it's going to take a long time. And therefore it's so important to help you have some joy and meaning in your life to make time. And you're going to say, well, I don't have time because I have the kids and I have my job and I have to deal with my spouse. My spouse doesn't let me go. And it's true. I don't have a good answer for that. And maybe you have to start really small, and it's not all or nothing, but make time for yourself. And you'll actually see that's going to help your self-confidence. They're going to play a role because you'll feel a sense of mastery. You'll feel like a person. And when you have a person, you're going to be able to feel more secure within yourself.
Okay, second question. What is your belief regarding the treatability of personality disorders? 14% of people say they can effectively manage with proper support and therapy. 41%, most people, but majority, they are difficult to treat, but improvements are possible. Number two answer came out, number two, 34%, they are mostly unchangeable with minimal potential for improvement. And number four, I'm not sure, I need more information to form an opinion.
I don't see it in front of me. I'm sure it's that way there.
It's there, so maybe you have to move down or something, but it's there.
Oh.
It's basically 40% that they feel effectively can be managed, 41%. They are difficult to treat, but improvements are possible.
Okay.
34% believe they're mostly unchangeable with minimal potential for improvement.
Yeah, so I think that's pretty spot on. I'm really happy to hear that people do understand that there is some hope, and, you know, maybe minimal, maybe sometimes more than minimal, depends on the severity. I think we've come a long way. I think we have a lot of new treatments, a lot of new perspectives, a lot of knowledge, a lot of programs like Coach Menachem, where you guys are really out there helping us educate and understand and provide support. And I think that's why I don't think that those would have been the answers 10 years ago. I could be wrong. I don't know. But it definitely makes, you know, for someone who's spent a lot of my career wanting to help this population and support this population move towards change, and we have evidence-based practices that can help move towards change and help in family members to change dynamics and move towards change. And even if they ended a relationship, also how to navigate a relationship when they're leaving the relationship, because there's a lot more support out there for mental health. So I'm hopefully those numbers will just rise. And, you know, we'll see more improvement.
Okay, so we have a lot of questions. Anybody wants to ask a question, please text. Again, live questions will go first. Matis, I'll just let everybody know, if anybody watched Shear 96, thank you for remembering the number. Mm-hmm. Matis can't hold his own. Very nice, edel, sweet guy, but when the pushback comes strong, he was pretty good. So feel free to challenge him or any
as
questions.
As long as you don't call me narcissist, we're good.
You look so young. I love your people your age. Okay, Gidon, go first.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you much for coming on. This is some intense stuff. So, question I have. So it's easy, really easy to view people struggling with bad cases of either borderline or narcissism as cruel or evil. Like, especially like you know, that one day you're amazing, the other day, you know, insert pejorative here. So instead of viewing them as cruel or evil, what's a better way to relate to them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, when we say cruel and evil, those are labels, right? And everyone, because if you ask them, are they cruel and evil, they're not going to say they're cruel and evil. Because, and the label is not necessarily accurate. So what we try to teach is to describe the consequences of their behaviors. We're not denying the harmful and the painful and the destructive. We're describing the outcome of their behavior. So in other words, is, you know, when they did A, B, and C, it actually made me feel like I don't want to be in a room with that person again. So you're not saying they're cruel. You're describing. Now, obviously, I'm going to go back to that in a second. Obviously, I'm not expecting this of you, but that's a whole different level. And certainly as a therapist, we have to really understand causes. So when you really want to be empathetic, you really want to look at the causes of their behavior and make sense of their behavior in some way that helps you be a little bit more understanding of behavior. But let's say you're not at that level. Okay. That's a whole different level. We could talk about that separately. But if you can at least be able to say, you know, when I ask for something and, you know, simply, or I give just some feedback of something I appreciate and the person starts yelling at me that I'm not appreciative and I don't do anything right. That's extremely painful and hurtful. And as a result of that, I feel like just getting out of this relationship. So I'm describing the impact of the behavior and how it makes me feel and think. And it's really harmful without labeling it. Do you hear the difference between saying, oh my gosh, they're so cruel. I asked them for something and suddenly they're just screaming at me. Or every single time I come home on time, today I had a crazy day. I come home 10 minutes late and now they scream at me and they don't even appreciate the other times I tried 50 times. I mean, that's downright cruel. As opposed to is, you know how frustrating it is? I try every single day to come home and I come home 10 minutes late because I'm doing something for them and I get yelled at. It's extremely painful to the degree is I don't know if I can last in a relationship like this. Do you hear that difference?
Yeah, I hear. It's, I guess, separating, sort of being able to accept your own emotions and I guess the way that they're, what they're doing is making you feel without, it's not who the person is essentially.
Well, you're using a skill called, you're describing what is.
Right.
You're describing the facts of what is without labeling what is.
Oh, I heard the word.
So if you could imagine like it's a scene of a play, right? You're describing the things that are happening without labeling what's happening.
Yeah, here.
Okay, Matos, let's go to the next live question. Hold on. Hi.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for bringing up about narcissism. I'm living with my husband who has it for a long time. And he does a lot of stonewalling and he runs. He's a constant runner away from it. And all I would like to have is what an answer to this. Should I do this? You know, would you like this or this? And I don't get any answers. And it's like an endless circle and it just drives me nuts. But I'm also learning to do self-care because that's very important. I decide I'm living with him, not leaving. I accept him unconditionally because that's the way I have it. I have a beautiful family. I want that. I want the family. That's what I want. But I don't know how to deal with the stonewalling and he has rage also, a lot of rage. And I think this is from his childhood also. He wasn't being hurt enough. So I see it coming onto me and everything else. So I'd like any advice you can give me. Thank you.
Yeah. I appreciate you sharing that. If you're willing to, I don't know how effective this will be, but I would like to try something. First of all, again, as I said before, you're an amazing individual. Just the way you describe that and focusing on the family and acceptance. So I could hear the depth of your acceptance, which I don't think many people can do. And I know that takes a tremendous amount of work.
Mm-hmm.
I want to try a little bit of a role play with you here for everybody. Specifically, you know, you mentioned that when it comes to asking for A or B, maybe you can give me an example, and then perhaps you'll be him if you're comfortable, and I'll be you.
Okay, I'm trying to see what I can do. I happen to work for him. I didn't want to say that.
You happen to what?
I happen to be working for him also, so there's a lot of, sometimes there's anger there, but then I know that's his problem. Then what I try to do is go away from him, because if he's raging, I like to go away to another place if I can, and it's hard, you know, but I also know in my head, this is his problem. I'm also doing step work for myself.
Great.
I really want to do everything I can think of, and I'm doing that. And I just try not to answer him and just go on and just, you know, and deal with everybody nicely and let him. But the hard thing is what I have an actual problem that he has to fix the computer. I need him there, you know, like I can't help him. I'm trying to help his patients. So it just gets crazy.
Yeah.
And deep down, he's a good person, and other people know him also outside of the day, outside of the of my house, so they know about him also. So,
okay, it sounds like this might be hard to role play for you, but either way, I guess
try it. You have nothing to lose.
Okay, so what would be a situation that you would ask of him?
I'd ask him a question, but then he'll say, you're interrupting me.
Tell me the question. What would be
What kind of question? Like, I'm trying to figure out about tomorrow. Like, should I, do you want me to come in? Because I can work at home tomorrow.
Okay.
So he says, I don't know. We'll see. Okay. I'll talk it. But then he forgets and then he goes up and then I don't know what he wants anymore. So.
Okay. So I'm going to be you and you're going to be him. Okay. And I want you to try to be the most difficult him you can be, if possible. Okay. So I was thinking tomorrow is Friday and, I have a lot to do before Shabbos. Do you want me to come into the office tomorrow? You know, and I know when I bring up this topic, sometimes you can get frustrated, when I bring up this topic, which I understand because work's really important and you run a good business here and it could be frustrating, but I really, I want to do what's best for the business. So I just want some clarity. If it's, should I come to work tomorrow or is it okay if, I work from home?
He would say something like, you're going all over the place, Jane. You're talking too much, Jane. You know, figure it out, Jane. He would do something like that. Or he says, I don't know. We'll see. I'll try me later.
Yeah.
You know, try me later. This is something he would say. I mean, I just had to experience with this.
So you got a lot in your head. You're really, really busy. And I get that. But just for me, I really want to connect to you and I really want to be there for you. It's just when I keep getting pushed off, I feel like you're not hearing what I have to share here. So I just need clarity for my day tomorrow. So is this something that we could, you know, speak about in 20 minutes? Do you need 20 minutes? I can come back to you. Or can we talk about this now just to get some clarity? Because that would really help me here.
I would say it depends on, like, I was able to ask him a question when he first came home. So it depends if something else is not preoccupying his mind.
Okay.
You know.
We're out of the role play. Well, my point is, and I know people are thinking, oh my gosh, she's being easy. So, but I'm going to say to you like this.
Okay.
My point is the answer is not just avoid necessarily. Now, if it's working for you and it's being effective, that's okay. But perhaps you can learn empathetic confrontation. Perhaps you could learn to put up some boundaries. Perhaps
that's what I also have trouble with, boundaries.
Yeah.
He knows how to go past them.
Yeah.
And I think the empathetic thing is you're talking about disarming, right? Is that another way to say disarming?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good one to do. Yeah. Disarming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
So I would try to do that. Like let him know that I know, I feel for you. I really do. And you have a good point here. And I do admire him for his practicality. I need the practicality.
You gotta tell him that. He loves that. He loves that. You talk about the practice. We're gonna go to the next question because.
Okay, thank you. Okay. I know how it is. Anyway, I appreciate the information. Thank you.
My pleasure. Hatzlacha to you.
Let's go to the next one, Marcus.
Okay.
I have the last one. Hold on. 1 second. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for a great talk. I'm a survivor of extreme abuse. My diagnosis is complex PTSD. You know, one psychiatrist thought diagnosed me BPD, but my therapist mostly feel it's the word you use, the character traits similar to BPD due to the severe fear of rejection and abandonment by those closest to me growing up. I will say you gave a disclaimer about getting off, and I actually felt validation the way you described where it comes from. So thank you for your sensitivity. But I had a two-part question. The biggest challenge in my relationship is obviously with my wife, specifically reconciling severe hurt done in my relationship. One, have you found any better outcomes for those exhibiting BPD traits where it clearly stems from severe trauma if they're working on trauma, which I've been doing for a long time in many different modalities, including inpatient? And two, is there any advice you would offer my wife, who's not on, but I can relay that in terms of specifically the, well, you spoke about the difficulty navigating her own emotions in relation to when I get dysregulated, which is often now a little better, while yet balancing her empathy for me because, you know, she knows about all the abuse. So those are my two questions.
Okay, I just want to reflect back to make sure I understood the two questions. So firstly, you know, you share that you've been through, you know, a history of trauma, and that has, and perhaps have some traits associated with BPD as a result of that trauma and the fear of rejection, abandonment, and you've done a lot of work. And your question regarding that is like, what else can you do? Was that the question? I wasn't sure.
No, I really, it's almost tied to the second poll question, like in terms of outcomes, where the BPD traits are tied directly to trauma. Clearly, when someone works significantly on their trauma, I find myself being able to regulate much. I've done DBT. I've done EMDR. I'm almost looking for validation that work, because that's what I keep being told, like just work on the trauma and everything else will fall into place.
Yeah, no, it's such a great question. I'm so glad you brought it up in terms of treatment. DBT is a very, very effective treatment. And I think it's primarily effective for what we would say stage one, stage two for sure, is that when people have severe emotion dysregulation and behavioral discontrol, they need the skills and the strategies to regulate their emotions, to tolerate the stress, to be more effective in their interpersonal interactions, to learn dialectical thinking, to increase flexibility and decrease rigidity, to be able to self-validate their own emotions and make sense of their experiences, to become aware of their own emotional vulnerability and understand where that emotional vulnerability stems from and how it impacts them. And if they're engaging in unhealthy ways of coping, being able to target those and learn other skills to generalize in their environment with coaching to be able to implement new, more effective ways. At the same time, to build pleasure in their life, self-care, build mastery, learn how to problem solve, mindfulness, awareness, decrease judgment. So much is there. At the same time, though, most often there is fractured attachment associated with people who have, a borderline personality disorder and severe trauma. And therefore, I've treated many people, and I can tell you that, and they'll say themselves, they needed the DBT. It was really essential. And sometimes that's enough. But many people also very often, and even dialectical behavioral therapy now is integrating a lot of evidence-based work to address trauma, prolonged exposure work, cognitive processing therapy, and different type of therapy. The work that I actually do, schema therapy, is that once a person is at a better place to be able to deal with their emotions, because opening up that trauma and addressing it when they're so unstable and so extreme in their emotion, it's too difficult and it's too painful. It's essential in order to really, really heal, in order for that, like you say, that fear of rejection, that loneliness, that abandonment is going back to that little child who grew up in the environment that you grew up in. And in schema therapy, we call limited reparenting. We actually go back in imagery to go ahead and provide those needs and give this sense of safety and security and strong attachment, because it's fascinating in this work, because someone could be in a session all emotional that this person is leaving them or rejecting them, you can go ahead and do that work in processing, addressing that underlying trauma, then go back to the situation right at the end of the session to what's going on in the present. It's gone. They don't feel it because it's so strongly linked back to that past. And addressing that trauma is essential, but the DBT is also essential. And DBT is also incorporated in that. And there are many modalities, even using EMDR in terms of processing trauma. I do EMDR work as well, but all that different components are important. Did I answer that question?
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Okay. And the second thing about your wife was?
More just overall, it's really what you spoke about, but like she's very familiar with the trauma. So there's when I get dysregulated and she knows it's, related directly to my childhood, there is empathy, but yet, how could she navigate if she's hurt or, I guess the overall, really what you discussed.
Yeah, I would say two things on that. First of all, is if we can say there's a cause, but we're responsible for our own problems. So even though it was caused by that trauma, the example I often give when I teach skills groups, I said, if you're, walking by a lake on a path and a biker comes and knocks you over and you fall into the water, and you start to drown and you say, I'm not swimming out of this. I didn't put myself here. Someone else knocked me here. Right. And the answer is you don't have to, but you're going to go under. So children are not responsible to fix their own problems. Parents' responsibility is to help children. But as adults, although there's a cause, we're still responsible. So what I suggest is first giving the message is, I'm working on myself like you are, which is amazing. I can hear it. And I take responsibility, but understand there's a cause for this. And it's coming. It makes sense based on my experiences. And what I would suggest is perhaps bringing your wife into one or two therapy sessions or your individual sessions together and helping her and the therapist help you be able to communicate what are those triggers, what is activating, how this makes sense, so that she can even become part of the language. And maybe then communicate that and says, I think some of this is coming up for you right now. Is that little boy? Is that the vulnerable child? Is that, is that triggering something based on your past or something like that, which will help you feel understood and validated, which will actually help you regulate your emotions because you will feel understood and you will be less judgmental to yourself.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, sure.
All right, let's go to the next one, Mathis.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good, thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Mathis, for offering all of your experience. We really appreciate that. The last caller did touch on this a little bit. You were focusing more for the person that's involved in relationship with the person with the personality disorder. Can you focus a little bit more for the person that has the personality disorder, specifically OCPD that you mentioned? Also, when they're sensing, and we're talking about people that are very self-aware and they're sensing their triggers and what they can do in that moment and how not to hurt other people, from those triggers.
So first of all, what's promising about OCPD, which I like to say every time I talk about OCPD, I wasn't going to talk about it, but they are great clients, by the way. They are the best because they really do the work. They follow the rules and they put in the effort and they're really meticulous and they really, it's really promising for them, when they do that because they really want to do it. And I can hear that in your voice. Like you really want to get
they're very rigid. They're very rigid about doing the work, huh?
Yeah, sometimes too rigid about the work, but but they are rigid about doing the work. I think what I find the most difficulty in a dynamic in a relationship with OCPD is again, really gets back to what I said before, is where the standards and their rules and their expectations is they're putting that on the other person. They're not saying, could you really try to put these away because, for me, I struggle that because I would have such a critical voice from the way I grow up or I have certain belief systems that are strong. And it just brings up soul motion. So it's really not your issue. It's my issue. But if you can, I'd really appreciate it. Taking that responsibility and that awareness is huge. The problems in the relationship, you know, is when the guy comes into the kitchen and takes his hand and wipes it across the counter and says, this is filthy. Or the guy who walks in and, you know, there's a diaper, you know, sitting on the floor that she changed the baby 2 minutes ago because the other four kids are screaming in the other room. Like, that's gross. How can you leave that there? You know? And that's where it's really affecting the relationship. But if you can have communication and you can really explain the cause and take the responsibility and also describe the things you like and also say that sometimes, by the way, I get into that emotional pace because it's so hard for me when I see you deviating and not doing things like I think really hashkafically, it's really supposed to be like this. It's how I learn. And I might react, know it's coming from my emotion and from my, and I'm really working on it. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. And specific skills, let's say therapeutic skills, which ones would you recommend?
For OCPD? Definitely cognitive work. A lot of cognitive therapy, identifying rules, conditional assumptions, beliefs about perfectionism, need for control, difficulty with uncertainty, and followed by exposure work of really doing things imperfect and learning to do things imperfect, you know, perfectly imperfect. But also you have to be careful not to do it just because you're told to do it. So you're following the rule. But it really, but that exposure process of really learning how to let go and obviously regulating your emotion and really addressing the underlying developed beliefs that go back all the way through your childhood and reframing them and restructuring them and even using experiential strategies and techniques. That could be role plays, gestalt therapy, psychodrama, certain things like that. But cognitive therapy, straight up cognitive behavioral therapy can be extremely effective with OCPD.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, Matas, I'm taking in all this information and you could hear how hard it is to actually, you know exactly what to do. And when people ask, you tell them exactly, but just to understand that it takes time. And here's a question that somebody sent in. I spend hours each week trying to ensure everything is just right for them, from keeping the house perfectly organized, adjusting my schedule for their needs, yet it still seems like it's never enough. Why does it feel like nothing I do is ever enough to meet their emotional needs, and how can I stop feeling like I'm failing?
Yeah. So first of all, I'm so sorry because it sounds like you're really entrapped in that cycle as we discussed. And you really highlighted two of those schemas, your own schemas that we talked about. Number one is people pleasing, you know, wanting to make sure the person's happy. And two is failure. Okay. That your failure scheme is coming, that you're failing. Now I can tell you, I can take someone on this call, whoever they are here, and they would not think you're a failure and would tell you, stop, stop trying so hard. Stop trying to please them for everything. It's okay. Doesn't mean there's something wrong with you because you can't please them.
They don't want them to be upset. They don't want them to be upset. They can't live with it.
And remember I said, make space for the emotion, is that we really have to be able to tolerate. Yeah, they're good. Now you're right. I'm not going to be able to answer all that. And I don't know the dynamic of a relationship and it could be much far more severe than I realized. But the idea is, you know, if you can tolerate and put up those firm boundaries and be clear and be consistent and be secure, and be empathetic at the same time, but you're not going to do those things. You know, you're not going to do those things for that person. You're going to put up a line and you're going to learn that my job is not to make them happy. To the extent that I think I need to make them happy, because basically, they have unmet emotional needs of some sort clearly, and this is what they need to keep them going. And if you're not going to provide it, they're going to get angry at you, and there you're going to see the rage, and you're not taking care of me properly, and so on and so forth. I'm assuming that's what you're referring to. And so the answer is that, you know, you can say to them, you know, this is not something I can do. And I understand it's something you want, and it's something that makes you feel good, and I'm really doing the best I can. And then they stomp off and they don't talk to you for the next couple of hours, and that's okay. And if it comes to a point that you have to use some leverage, say, you know, I'm not going to continue in a conversation with you, or I'm not going to, you know, sit down with you after and do A, B, and C until, you know, we have a conversation where I, you know, you acknowledge something, whatever it might be. And then, of course, they're going to put you down and dismiss you again. And it's going to be a lot of a back and forth process, and maybe it won't work. But you're a person, and you need to take care of yourself. And you not meeting their needs does not make you a failure. And just because they have an emotional struggle, that doesn't mean you're responsible to fix their struggle. And by the way, how about them taking care of your needs, right? Is relationships one way? Now, I'm not saying they will, but it seems like you have this belief system that, you know, I have to be that Isha Kshira idea, you know, and just make sure they're always happy. But it's a larger conversation, but I hope that was helpful.
You're saying sometimes they can feed into the continuation of the problem.
Because also the behavior will continue because they're getting their needs met by showing disappointment. They get you to work harder. It works. They should continue it because it's getting their needs met until that cycle is broken.
Well,
Matis, can we get into a little bit the self-care? Like, how does somebody who's married to somebody with personality disorder, whether man to woman to man, like, how do they, like, without dysregulating themselves, realize that they need space for themselves and to say it respectfully and to actually do it? Because I feel like a lot of these relationships end up getting manipulated in the person doing, trying, and then they're, like, burnt out.
So I hope today would be a start, that if someone's here on this call, that awareness from both of us understand the importance of self-care. I think a lot of people think the reason why they don't give them self-care is because they feel they're not deserving. I don't deserve self-care. You know, I my job is to take care of other people. So obviously there's a belief associated. But my answer is to go opposite that emotion. We call that opposite action. Do it anyway. Schedule it and do it. And do it every week and do it as what we call an experiment.
I want to just clarify something about this. What happens is when you're married to somebody like that, what happens is part of your personality gets over the years, you learn to become a caretaker or to and you're almost like you feel you're not worthy of that self-care. So it becomes like self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes, yes. And what I'm saying is don't wait till you feel worthy. Do it anyway. Because if you feel till you're worthy, that's going to be a lot of therapy. Okay? So what I'm saying is do it anyway. Schedule it anyway. Go even if you're not worthy. And do a small, if that works for you. Put a little something every week.
A few examples of something small that you...
Sure, sure. Pick yourself up a coffee once a week from your favorite coffee shop. Go to an exercise class, okay? Not for exercise because he told you you need exercise. Exercise because you want to go with a group of people and you want to feel good or have a little time once a week. Take a walk and listen to some music on a nice sunny day in the summer. Call a friend. Have a phone call with a friend. Do it in your car if you have to because you don't want him to see you on the phone. Once. And the more you do it, first of all, you start to feel better, so you're going to want more, right? And secondly, you'll realize, I think you'll feel more empowered, and it will help you start to believe that there is, especially when you're interacting with other people. Because, you know, what happens to people who are struggling like this, like they try, they become very lonely. They become isolated. And they don't end up interacting with healthy people in the environment, and they don't get positive feedback. So when they go out and they make these small steps, and by the way, behavior, action, your body communicates to your mind. So when I buy the coffee, okay, that buying of the coffee is communicating to my mind that I'm getting a coffee for myself. So it doesn't have to be that I'm logically necessarily there, but even the action can help change. So that action and also being around other people who will smile at you, who will say good morning, who will give you a good word, who say, oh, you look so nice today. Oh, really? What do they want from me? And they're like, no, they don't want anything. They just want to be my friend. They just like me. So I think that there's some, it could be, but small steps, little bit, even if you don't feel worth it.
I want to ask one more question, is that when you do that self-care, you do interact with healthier people, it could have a negative but a positive effect at the same time, because when you do go back into that, you start realizing maybe this is not so healthy, but this is not, like, I am more respected, like, I could have a healthier relationship. It could, yeah. Not in a bad way, it's going to negatively affect the relationship, because in a certain sense, you're going to get validation from healthy people.
Let's talk about this on a bigger scale, okay? Your question here. I start going to therapy, and right. My therapist starts to empower me, right? And then suddenly I come in, and I'm like, you know, I'm starting to internalize these messages, which throws off the whole dynamic in the relationship and can create more problems. Okay.
Yeah, marital issues, don't go to therapy.
Don't go to therapy. Therapists waste time, waste the money. No. So, so the answer to that is one has to be very careful, you know, in finding that balance. It's a very, very delicate balance, especially if your goal is to maintain the relationship. You know, the answer is, you know, I'm moving away from this to an area which is easier to talk about somewhat. Is a lot of times in therapy, we're addressing parent-child relationships, right? And even if the parent is someone healthy, I wish that I meet the need of every need that my children have. I don't, okay? I will do everything I can, but I know it's not realistic to meet all those needs. I hope with Hashem's help, I'm meeting a nice amount of those needs so that they can grow up to be healthy. But we cannot meet every need of every child in every situation, emotional action, and so on and so forth. And we're doing the very best we can with the tools and the know-how and the information we have. What happens is if someone goes into therapy and you start to highlight all the problems in that parent-child relationship, if done ineffectively, can actually lead to anger and bitterness and actually hurt the relationship. But if done effectively, even if you have them express their anger, because I've done that in schema work, having them express their anger to that punitive, critical parent, it actually helped the relationship because they were able to express, get distance from their schemas, and they were able to have more compassion and space and understanding of what their parent went through or the experiences which helped them have more. So it's just the same thing as even if you get that from the outside and you get that positive, you have to go back in with an understanding of the consequences of those behaviors. It's not so simple, you know, to just feel empowered, right? Because you might get more hurt. And that's why I said I was teaching you skills about being empathetic, about giving them their needs with someone struggling with narcissism or with someone with a borderline personality disorder, giving them their validation, giving them their reassurance. If I go in with ideas like, no, I'm not doing this anymore, right? You're going to have problems.
Okay. A lot of questions. Let's try to get some more in. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question, not for me specifically, but it's extended family, so I'm affected. But do you have any advice for helping someone who is oblivious to her husband's coercive control tactics, that he's not diagnosed with a personality disorder, but exhibits signs of narcissistic personality disorder. And she, the wife, has isolated herself from healthy friends and family. Is there anything to do other than just not take it personally when all the, I don't even know how to explain, but the things the spouse says come up in conversation, and just hear that she feels this way even about things that are not true, and say, I'm still, like, I'm here for you if you need me. Is there anything to, like, open her eyes to what's been happening?
This is a really, really, really painful reality. And I can tell you where I've seen it. I don't know if this is your situation. When someone has a child who marries someone, and that person, and they see their daughter, their son, start to isolate, to interact differently with you, to distance themselves from their siblings, it's extremely painful, and you're just watching it. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of limits of control because on the one hand, it is their relationship and they're adults now. It's not your child. I'm giving the example with a child. I don't know where you're going, but I'm going to stay with that because it's something that many can relate to. And you really, really can't. And people try. They say, let's go with therapists together. Let's, you know, let's communicate. Let's sit down. What can I do? And they're not. They're just not willing. They're becoming more and more isolated. And you just wish they would see what's going on and how they can have such a better life and how this is so unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
First thing, it's easy for me to say because I'm not in this situation right now. But the first thing is, you know, we think we want to make them aware and get it all involved, but we don't really know what's going on behind closed doors.
So, mm-hmm.
You know, perhaps the current way it is right now is better than them being aware in a way, maybe where their skills or their strength or their capability or whatever it is, they're doing, yes, unhealthy. It's their adaptive, perhaps maladaptive way of survival. And to just come in and break that dynamic might just be too much for them right now.
Mm-hmm.
Too overwhelming. Like imagine sitting them down and saying all this, it might actually create more distance from you and them. Oh, you don't understand. That's not like that, right? Or they might be so affected by the other person that they can't hear the information. So getting too involved in the process can actually create more pain and distance, believe it or not. My hope would be...
I've seen many times, like when these situations happen, is that once, like, let's say the problem comes out or they, you know, this person starts... Mm-hmm. And then they start opening up about it. Like some people turn to them like, oh, we've seen this for such a long time. We didn't say anything. We didn't like, people will like validate you afterwards, but people do see it and they just, as a friend or as a family member, you basically have to stay quiet because if you open your mouth or you say anything, you usually like get cut off or is that correct, Martha? It's like you.
Yeah. And I would say to you, this is with the understanding that you tried the normal responses, like the first time it happened, you said you made it and then you got severe pushback or the person, like you said, Usher, the person cut you off. Like you got the communication. Don't go there. Like you've done the basics. I'm not going to say you should watch and not say anything. You might say, by the way, I think maybe you should speak to someone or this is not necessarily, I'm seeing some things. I'm a little concerned. I'm worried about you, you know, something like that. But, the other thing is the hope, obviously, what else could we do? I should state this obviously at the start, is we all don't really, we all struggle with really appreciating the power of tefillah. But, Nisim happen, we daven to Hashem to give that person the insight, the awareness, the healthy for that family, for that relationship, that there should be shalom. We could daven that every day in Shemoneh Esrei. We could have a mind for shalom and you know, That's certainly. The other thing is the being there for when they're ready.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping the relationship as much as you can and being aware of your own emotions so that when they will want to open up, they can feel safe and secure and that you won't judge them and you're with them every step of the way. The problem is that people are pushing back or like, well, I'm not going to have anything to, or they break the relationship or this is not okay. This is not how kids are supposed to act towards parents. Being there to the best of your ability, loving, consistent, I believe that will shine at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Matthias, if somebody in a relationship like that is listening tonight, what's something that you can tell them? There's a lot of fear. They might be stuck. They can't talk to anybody. How can they help themselves in that situation?
If you're really scared for your own survival or you're scared you're going to be harmed in some way, or there are organizations, there are people there that you can call confidentially and they, you don't have to give your name, that they will give you steps to make plans towards safety, plans on how to put money away, how to get a place to go, how to deal with repercussions, how to deal with Rabbanim, how to deal with courts. There are people, you know, the Shalom Task Force is just one example of an organization that does that. But you can reach out and to people, I know you're scared, but they will hold your hand. You're not the first person who's done this. And there are people who have gotten, you know, help with very, very difficult relationships. And I know there might be severe threats and all those things. I'm not saying those threats aren't real, but there are people who are experts at helping people like you.
Okay. Let's go to the next slide. Hi.
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 Thank you for doing what you do. So I missed a lot of it, but I'm glad I caught up a little bit. And I'm just wondering, where do these things come from, the borderline personality and narcissism? And is it a parent's fault? And if it is, what to do?
Yeah, so I don't love the word fault. I like using the word cause. Okay. But it is possible that parents were a cause. It's also possible they weren't a cause. So let's start with, I've talked about this a little bit on the other class, which I mentioned in the beginning that I gave on borderline personality disorder. So it might be worthwhile, but let's just focus on that one for the moment. Is that what we know the theory in developing, borderline personality disorder is people who are born with emotional sensitivity. There's actually a new diagnosis. That's really what I based my book on, The Uncontrollable Child, is disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. Is that individuals are born with a heightened sensitivity to the frequency, intensity, and duration of emotional experience. Is that they feel emotion. Emotion could just come out of nowhere very, very frequently. When they experience the emotion, it's very, very intense. It's like a third degree burn patient, just someone touches it and it's burning. And the duration, it takes longer to baseline. When they interact with an environment that doesn't understand those emotional needs, that environment could be a traumatic, invalidating environment or abusive environment or just an invalidating environment, not purposely. The person can be a tulip in a rose garden and the environment just says, like, why are you crying so much? Don't get so nervous. It's okay. It's not such a big deal. And that actually leads to inhibiting emotion or increasing emotion and getting reinforcement, which leads to dysregulation. So it's the nature and the nurture together that leads to that. And that's reinforced over time when the environment can't teach the child how to self-soothe in that way. There also can be that someone has held certain, abuse or certain information or things like that. It could just be that someone grew up in a very invalidating environment and not necessarily having that emotional sensitivity. It could be it's very, very loving, healthy parents and all their kids are great, but this one is struggling with it. So it doesn't necessarily have to be. Narcissism also, there are, that conceptually, and I'll go through some of them. Some is where they grow up in a family or an environment where there's a heightened sense of entitlement. And that message of entitlement is coming over. We're special people. We're a special family. We have yichus. We're from very, very special Rabban. We're different than the other people around us. And that message is given over consistently, and we have to learn, the child grows up to learn that message. Maybe they're in an environment where there's no space for emotion. Emotion's not okay. Emotion's a place to be over-controlled, right? We don't show vulnerability. We don't express those things. We stay strong. Maybe it's an environment where they're very dependent on those in their environment, and they don't learn to be self-sufficient. They learn to everyone else to take care of their needs. So there are so many conceptualizations of that, and targeting that in therapy and looking at those causes can actually help make those changes with that awareness and changing their system and their state of mind.
Wow. How does a loss of a parent affect all this?
So again, nothing's black and white, and we conceptually could think of causes and we can't say it, but a loss of a parent obviously leads to especially a lot of feelings of alone, of being left alone. And if someone didn't grieve properly, or sometimes we have that sudden death, or the person was sick for a long time and it was never shared with the person, and then they were left with a sense of abandonment and aloneness that was never processed, can actually lead to develop that fear of being isolated or alone, or never work through their emotions, or they're a sensitive individual and they went through this traumatic event and never got the proper help because they didn't have that environment to give them proper support. So certainly something significant like that can affect.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, now we're going to take it to the next level. when it's, here's a question. How can I handle co-parenting with my ex who has a personality disorder? Seems to be influencing the kids against me. And what strategies can I use to support my children and maintain a healthy relationship with them despite these challenges? So, you know, when you're going together to therapy and you're working on things, like you're saying, Matt, this is amazing, but what happens when it's an ex and the communication is a struggle?
Yeah, so this is a very, very painful reality, and it could probably be a talk on its own. I actually had the schuss to a few Shabbosim ago. There's an amazing organization called Sister to Sister for women who are divorced, and I spent Shabbos with them and spoke a couple times over the Shabbos, and this came up a lot, obviously, especially when they have an ex who's putting down the co-parent and blaming them, taking zero responsibility, and it's very, very confusing for a child, and it's also activating all the other schemas for the individual and making it, they work so hard to get out of this relationship and they're still suffering so much. So there's much I would say on this, but I want to give just say one point, which I think is what I've seen in my experience in working with people in divorce. And this is one of the messages I gave over consistently. And that message is if you are not going to get stuck in that process, and you are going to not and stay strong and not, even though it's so easy to be defensive and the judging and the blaming and to fall into that whole process. But I believe with children, I can't say always, and obviously they're going to have to do their work because this is a reality. But if you are that consistent parent who's there, who's loving, who's not putting down the spouse like they're putting down you, who's not using judgment and labeling, who's responding in a very stable, grounded, consistent way and being there for the child, when the child grows up, they will know where that secure attachment is. That is the message, really. I'm not saying there won't be damage along the way, and I'm not saying that there's not things you can't control, but I do believe that those, because I've seen it, I remember I had a client I worked for years, and as he grew up, he started to see the unhealthiness more and more and more. And he started to, gravitate towards mom and learn in therapy how to put up boundaries with dad in that case. But that took a lot of work and a lot of years and a lot of patience.
And you as a therapist couldn't show him the truth. I'm wondering what you did all along as a therapist.
Again, as I mentioned to someone earlier, is we can definitely describe and identify and highlight based on their perspective what is unhealthy, and knowing their boundaries in place in terms of healthiness and learning how to say no and learning how to be appropriate and learning how to be respectful. It's not all or nothing. And we can do that without, at the end of the day, it's still their father and they love them and they want a relationship with them. And that's understandable and valid. At the same time, they want to learn how to put up boundaries and respect themselves.
Matt, so I want to bring up the topic a little bit about just, it seems like a lot of people do use, hey, you're laughing already. Here we go.
I know my customers. Yeah.
A lot of people use these words, Mary Cook, narcissist, my wife is a borderline. Anytime they get upset, like it becomes like the language. Like it feels like, almost if you go to any, I wasn't my sister to sister, but I can imagine everybody says they were married to a narcissist. That's probably like 85% of the people. Or probably the same thing by the men. Every woman that was dysfunctional, borderline. So
even though it's only 3% of the population, that's
something. I don't know. Yeah, you're saying it's 1-3%, but if you go to any divorced person, it's basically between 91-95%. Randomly people just say, oh, I got divorced because we just didn't get along. So my question is really, are people overdiagnosing it? Are we just, does every man and every woman have similar traits, and it gets exacerbated when people get
Kol Halashon.
It just seems to us like we're using the word a lot.
Yeah, yeah. I would say primarily, I can't say this as for sure, the people why is mostly for self-validation. When someone is in a situation or relationship and they were very, very hurt in that relationship, it's an easy way to go to validate themselves for their choices, for the deciding to get divorced, a way of expressing their hurt, right? Listen, there's a reason why we judge and blame. We all do. Scream and yell and give names, right? Because it feels good. It helps us self-validate. It helps us express. It's an easy language. People know what it is. It's much easier to say the person's an idiot rather than to describe what they're doing as problematic or hurtful. So I think to throw out those names, it's like a kosher way to call them a monster, which first of all, I don't love because again, that was for the other talk, but I don't think people struggling with these issues are monsters. Okay. There are people who are in tremendous amount of pain. And by the way, I have to say, certainly I've done a lot of my work with borderline personality disorder. I've seen amazing individuals who have come and risen above of all those childhood struggles and have made significant changes to their lives. And I have one person I've worked with where they recently came to me and said, my husband shared to me, we've been close. He feels closer to me than he ever did. And it's really due to both of their constant work and understanding. So I think using labels is really putting people in a box in an unhealthy way. I think it's a way of them expressing their anger and their frustration. I think it's better to talk. I think it's more effective to talk about, as I said, you know, the pain that they went through and validate that, because I've had people sitting in my office want validation that their spouse is a narcissist. And I could say those behaviors sound like narcissistic type of tendencies, or those sound like problematic behaviors, but they want me to label them and diagnose them and give them the, you know, cut their head off. And I'm not going to do that. First of all, I don't know them and I didn't assess them. But what I know is I can validate their valid reality and what's going on, what's hurting them, and help them give skills and strategies to deal with them. So I think it's easy. I think it feels good. I think it's an easy way to talk about the problems and label the person as bad and make yourself feel better. I just don't think it's an effective use of that for two reasons. Number one, it doesn't lead towards change. Right? When we make labels and judgments and blaming, it doesn't lead to change. Number two, I also really think for this person who is struggling with narcissism and working to better themselves, and there are a lot of people like that, and the people who are borderline, that's not who they are. It's a cluster of things that they're struggling with. But that doesn't mean there aren't people who are engaging in highly abusive behaviors. And there aren't people who have very severe levels. But as you said, Asher, I think to say that 85% and to throw out those names so easily is not really helping, because it also is like a little bit the boy who cried wolf sort of thing too. It's like, or it's just like it becomes table talk. And part of the reason, this is a personal, you know, obviously I run a big private practice. I have my intensive outpatient partial hospital. I do consultations. I'm doing supervision. I'm developing programs. I'm not really doing a lot of individual therapy at this point. I don't take any new patients. But when I did this in my early on career, when I was working with these individuals, no one else was helping and people wanted help. And that's why I took it upon myself. I said, yeah, this is hard. And yes, it wasn't my full caseload, but they're people and they're struggling, and there is, you know, so I think that's a danger of labeling it in a very pejorative way.
Just to end off, there's not a lot of question, but they say at the end of the day, a lot of narcissistic men married borderline women. It's like always the good shidduch because they fit with each other. So when you call the other person that, just remember and reflect. I'm just joking. Mm-hmm. But it's a good line.
Okay. I don't see it like that necessarily, but it's I guess it's a good line. But my experience.
Okay, let's go to the next question. Hi, you're up.
Hi. Okay, my next question, similar, I guess, to the last question. Someone who, I have a family member who has a personality disorder, and myself in dating, I'm very wary, which I think is natural, and like, I'm very quick to say no, because every little thing to me, I'm like, okay, this feels familiar and like, I'm not comfortable, but at what point, like, is it too much? Like, how does someone really supposed to do shidduch?
It's a great question. And I hear it. It's like, It's like, imagine, you know, I'm the therapist and my kids are going to start dating, you know? It's like, it's true. It's like when we're highly exposed to things and we really, we want that best, it's scary. And we overestimate danger. You know, I always make fun of myself. I say this in public. I say this a lot of times, but that my daughter, who's now in 12th grade, so the first time she came off the bus from camp, she walked off the bus and she was in primary, and I said to her, so how was your first day at camp? So she said, don't worry, Abba, no one touched me. I'm like, oh gosh, poor girl. I learned from there. But I made fun of myself. You know, in other words, it was an overdeveloped, you know, I'm so trained that I'm hearing about these things all the time. You know, I'm going to tend to, you know, be more heightened, you know, for those things. So I think the answer is, number one, you have to be aware, and exactly what you're doing, that you might be taking something and just taking it out of context. Because as I said, there's a continuum. Just because someone, like, it's okay. There's healthy narcissism. There's healthy, strong emotion. That's not necessarily going to be a problem in a relationship. And I mentioned Shalom Task Force before, that they have, maybe you want to take one of their courses on identifying red flags. You know, because there are specific red flags, but of course there's a level of uncertainty. And if you don't find that level of uncertainty, you might get stuck and not be able to jump in and commit to a relationship, which would be so sad, because, you know, relationships are the most important thing in life. I mean, that's what we know is the number one the cause of joy is not money. You know, it's not fame, is people have close connections and relationships. So, and marriage is a value of yours and it's important. So I think if you're aware that you're having that high, I think perhaps taking a course and learning what is like a red flag, and also understand that you're going to have to take a degree of risk. There's no way you're going to know absolutely for sure, but you want to be as careful as possible and know that your tendency is to go to extreme. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Let's take one last question, then we'll go to closing. Okay, you're on.
Hi. I wanted to ask, is it possible for these conditions to be, like, quote-unquote contagious or hereditary?
Yeah, it's a good question. We do know that it runs in families to some level. My guess is, again, I don't know all the clear research off the top of my head right now. Most of that is, and we see that, you know, with people, you know, borderline. So most of that if there's an emotional sensitivity could certainly be a genetic component. But just because someone has emotional sensitivity doesn't mean they develop borderline personalities. And just because you have one person in an environment who grows up with a sense of entitlement, or I'm supposed to get everything and everything belongs, that doesn't mean everyone else in the environment will grow up that way. However, if someone grows up with a person who's struggling with narcissism, there is an increased likelihood, because a lot of the behaviors that are being modeled and that are being in the environment and their way of talking and acting and things like that, or even in a relationship, what are they seeing a marriage as? You know, if they grow up for years and they see a certain marriage, certain context, it definitely... At the same time, someone who does have, let's say, a borderline personality disorder, and they really work on themselves and become aware of their emotions and understand themselves and get to a healthier place. And by the way, you don't have the criteria for life. I mean, people become non-borderline anymore, which is very, very possible. They actually can be amazing parents and actually really ensure that their children, help those children learn how to regulate their emotions, because they have learned so much how to regulate, and they could actually even be more helpful. But we definitely see it in families.
Mm-hmm. So I have another question that follows that. Is it possible for someone who's not, let's say, blessed with one of these challenges and living with two people who do have them, whether they're diagnosed or undiagnosed, to help facilitate some sort of healthy relationship between those two people? Is there any way to, like, influence better communication, better understanding of each other?
I'd really have to know the context and what's going on, so it's really hard to answer a question like that, but I'm going to just take a shot in the dark. If you have a relationship with those two people, and you can help individually help them understand what the other is experiencing and the cause and why they're responding, and that they do really want to connect to you, and you're telling them each that they do care about each other, and they're just, you know, teaching them some different ways of how they might try, and letting, you know, if you can support them each individually, to help understand one another, I think that might go a long way.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the hurt and pain. So,
Mathis, can we squeeze one more in?
Sure.
Okay. The last question of the night. Like the late, late show. Hi.
Hi, thank you. Sure. Okay, so I understand that these people could be healed or helped somewhat, but I feel like to get there is almost impossible. You know, how can you get these people to recognize that they need help? They're unbelievably blinded by themselves, and they'll go to any and all extreme to defend themselves.
Yeah, I'm so glad we had that late night question, because it's really important. Because some of them are really, some situations, you're right, like, it's just not. It's just, and that's why we leave relationships like that sometimes. And if we can't, we put up really strong boundaries in those extreme situations, because it's really hard. You know, with someone who's struggling with borderline personality or emotion dysregulation, it's much, much easier, because, as I said earlier, they're in a lot of pain, and they also want help, and they have anxiety, and they feel desperate. You know, they might fight it, but it's more likely they will get into treatment and they can get help. Okay. Someone who's struggling with other certain personality disorders or narcissism, it's really, really difficult. And that's why I said at one point, it's like, sometimes it's just leverage. There's no way it's happening without leverage. It's just not happening. And leverage might be anything, but from leaving the relationship, leverage, or you know, moving out until you get help, or leverage of, you know, the person gets fired from the job, as I mentioned, or leverage of, you know, people, a bunch of friends of his get together and say, listen, we're not going to be your friend anymore. Tell us when you're in therapy. You know, you're hurting too many people. You know, the shame of maybe it coming out and people becoming, you know, would be so painful that other people will know that that might be leverage. So sometimes you need that power, because there's no way they're going in for therapy. And then even if they get into therapy, doesn't mean that you're going to get too far, right?
It's more likely narcissism versus
yes,
the personality, if a person will absolutely not go for help.
What, again, one more time?
You'd say that it's narcissism versus borderline personality, if that person will absolutely, if they cannot recognize their pitfalls.
I'm not saying for everyone. I'm not saying for everyone. Some of them will. And some of them really, they have a problem, especially when they're young and this is not so ingrained and they get help early on. I mean, you see those symptoms. I mean, I've seen Bahram with those symptoms. I'm seeing them come out and they're in therapy and you can target them, you know, or someone who's newly in a relationship and starting to realize, like, you know, there's a breakdown right away. So what I'm telling you is, though, it's in the severe or a real meeting criteria, strong. Yeah, it's really, 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 really difficult in many cases.
Okay, and just a quick follow-up to that. There is the fear that, meaning, let's say this is a parent, right, and you have all children who recognize this, and the parent just feels like, you know, everyone else is driving the wrong way in the highway. If they would all, come together and to discuss this with the parent or to confront the parent on this, like, there's a fear that this person might, like, commit suicide or do something drastic or, you know, something along those lines. Like, is it worth it, or just everybody should just find their own way to help themselves and make this relationship the best or the most, you know, livable it can be?
I'm going to sort of end with this, because you're bringing up, like, a whole new subject. And this really applies to someone who's in pain and a borderline as well. Is they say, well, if you're going to put up this limit and boundary, I'm going to kill myself, right? And this happens a lot. And I really work with parents, you know, specifically to really help them understand, is there always a little bit of a risk? Yeah, but you have to know how to assess and you know how to push forward, because you're actually helping the person. You can't walk on eggshells. You can't live your life because they're going to say, I'm going to kill myself if. Okay. Now you're going to tell me if the person just lost their parent and they're in a very fragile place and they just came out of a psychiatric hospital for a failed attempt. Yeah. Not a good time to confront them. Okay. But if there is no history, you're not responsible. You can't for their, and it's not likely. Listen, I can't guarantee, and you can, no one's going to guarantee, but it's not likely, especially someone like that, that someone with borderline personality is sort of more so than someone with narcissistic personality, okay? Because they have a lot of, you know, the devaluation of self and insecure and a lot of suicidal thinking because of their intense pain. Someone struggling with narcissism, not the case. If there's no history, then I would not, again, I don't know the whole case, but I would tell you that that would not be a concern. And that it's not, you don't have to hold on to that responsibility.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, let's go to the closing segment over here. So again, thank you to Matis Miller again for coming on. Beautiful night, Chizik. Matis, tonight, okay. Not bad. Not bad. Nobody ate you alive.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful share. Thank you. There was a lot more questions for the people that are waiting. I'm sorry I couldn't get to you. But Shem Matis, just said before the share, he's like one of our regulars over here. She basically be on payroll at this point. He comes on, but we love when you come on, Matis. We find you to be deep, smart. You prepare. I love that, you know, you prepare before the share and you put energy in. This is not off the cuff. Matis puts energy into his work.
Yes.
And we really appreciate it. Again, tonight's share, every Sunday night, we do a share at 9 p.m. Different topics, different button. Next week's share, March 16th. It's not confirmed 100%, so we don't want to, post it all over, but the next day or two. Once we have the flyers, we'll send it out. And following that, the next Sunday, March 23rd, will be Rav Shulam Usher Talber, who was on once before discussing a very deep conversation, something I really chose. Deep care, self-care, understanding what it is, how to go about it, finding things that make you feel good, and really how to act on that, because we always use it. Even tonight we discussed a lot about it. But I really want to have a share just so people should understand what it is and how to go about it. So many people say the word self-care and they don't even know what that means. To them, self-care means taking a walk outside. Like, really going on a deep level of understanding it. So please join us for next week and the week afterwards. I wish you have a happy Purim. Tonight everything is recorded. It'll be much more on MenachemBerfel.com. If there's any questions, you can reach out to CoachMenachem@gmail.com. Tonight's share is 224. Matis Miller, 96. Matis Miller, 224. So, Matis, when you come on next time, remember those numbers.
Yes.
Corey will be on the phone line, 732-305-9011. Thank you to all the advertising sponsors, Lakewood Scoop, Elliot Ariel from Five Town Central, and Chayal Account from JCN. We're going to go to the closing. First Menachem, me, and then Matis. I just want to say, Matis comes on these very big topics, very, you know, clinical topics. They're hard to discuss. And I always tell Matis even when we've come on every time, like, every one of these stories have a lot of technicals and there's a lot of people involved. There's a lot of personalities involved. And we're just trying to give general concepts. And, you know, again, that's why we push therapy. Obviously go to good therapists, people that understand the disorders for the people that have it. We did a whole share on just, you know, getting the help that you need. And there's so much help out there today. And there's so many people in the circle that are going through different disorders. The people that are family members, there's also a whole other network, and there's a tremendous amount of chizik that you need and therapy you need and self-care that you need. So really hold yourself strong, pull yourself together, and get the proper help. Don't be a shmata. Don't be a martyr. And really be a healthy person to the best of your ability in these situations. And Hashem should help you. Coach Menachem.
Yes, Koyach Matas. Thank you again. It's not an easy topic. It's a heavy one. And like we heard, Hashem should help us all. And we need a lot of tefillah, especially in this situation. A lot of guidance to open our eyes. And like we heard, to seek the help, you know, go talk to someone. Because it's very confusing not knowing, is it me, is it them? Am I doing it right or wrong? You can be the nicest person, like we heard tonight, and you're actually feeding into that loop. All you need is some guidance to understand how to, like, don't feed into it. Stay where you are. And with that, you can get the, you know, slowly get the help, and the other person can actually They're not going to get what they need, and then they're going to seek, and this is how you interrupt that cycle. So how are we supposed to know? You know, we're new at this, or we're so used to this for so many years. How do we stop this? It's scary. It's confusing. So, you know, please go talk to someone, you know, start the process. And while, you know, with the Kapitel Tillim, reach out. And, hopefully, Mitz Hashem, Hashem should help us all. And again, we should be, have Simcha in our life, especially in Adar, and we should be able to continue it the whole year around. Thank you very much.
Matas, three things. People want to know how they get a hold of you. If they have questions, they want to know your address, they come down to your house. They want to know if they want to find out more information about the IOP, what the website is, or how they can find out about it. And the final thing is leave us, after 2 hours of dealing with a hefty topic, leave us with a strong closing. This is for the family members. So let's focus on that. Okay.
Okay, so if you want to reach me, we could put it in the chat there. Asher, you can, the best is via email. You can email me at either mmiller@cbtofnj.com or mmiller@enreachph.com. So that's mmiller@cbtofnj.com or mmiller@enreachph.com. If you want to, you know, contact the outpatient practice, I do consultations. You can also call 732-719-8143. Or again, you can email office@cbtofnj.com. If you're interested in information about Enriched Behavioral Health, our intensive outpatient partial hospital program, you know someone who can use those services. The consultation is free. Again, we have for adolescents, adults, different tracts, culturally sensitive. Yes, we helping people have personality issues as well. That's more intensive short-term work. And there you can email office@enreachph.com. Look at our website, EnreachBH. It's Enreach Behavioral Health, but I like to say EnreachBaruchHashem.com. So it's EnreachBH.com. You can get all the information. You can email us. The phone number, we'll put in the notes. The phone number is 732-905-5544. So that's some information about where you can contact and get some of that information. Asher, what was number two before the last part?
No, there was the contact you did in reach and leaving a closing for the, as a shares focus for the family members and spouses.
Yes.
The closing focus on that.
Yeah. So I'm going to focus on that because as we went from share 96, as you said, to today, which was really focusing on, the one end of the dialectic. And today we focused on the end of the other end of the dialectic is that the pain and the harm that people who are struggling with trying to be there and connect and support those who are struggling with personality disorders. And as I said, and I'll say it again, you know, living with that person, having a relationship with that person is very, very different. And when it's not a friend, and there are definitely relationships I had to end in my life that were not healthy relationships, but when it's something that's close, it's a spouse, it's a child, it's a family member, it's a close relative, it's a neighbor. Certain things you can't, and it is extremely, extremely painful. That doesn't mean those individuals are bad, but they are causing a lot of difficulty and pain in your life that I cannot measure in any way, and it's really severe. What I'd like you to take from this is, though, is that you can learn to put up boundaries. You can to learn your own triggers so you can learn to be more confident in your response. You can learn how to confront with empathy. You can learn how to validate and understand to help the other person regulate and understand their emotions. You can learn about their struggle and understand their cause so you can actually support them. You can also learn how, even if someone struggles with narcissism, how you can actually meet their needs in a way at the same time, putting up those, in that boundary at the same time. It's not all or nothing in this relationship. You could also, learn how to make space for those emotions, to get support from outside, to do your own work, to become the healthiest, healthiest person you can be able to interact with that environment. So I hope I gave you just, this topic is so huge and there's so much to talk about, but just opened your eyes a little bit to the idea, to the validation and support of the suffering, because it's very, very real. And also the understanding that sometimes perhaps there might be things that you can do to improve that relationship. And my message is Hashem should give each of you the strength and the siyat Shmaya, because that's what you need above all, to find the right shluchim, to find the inner strength, to be able to care for yourself so you can be there for others and yourself.
Amen.
Well, thank you, Matas. Thank you for coming on. Beautiful Abishai, have a wonderful Purim. Be happy and have a great time. I'm sure we'll see you next Sunday night with our surprise guest. Good night, everybody. Have a great week.
Kol HaLashon, a whole world of quality content.